This is The Politics Lab, a podcast that puts politics under a microscope. This week, Bill and Phil discuss the significance and implications of the U.S. bombing of Iran, and then move on to assess the results of the recent New York City mayoral race. Now let's go to the lab.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Politics Lab. My name is Phil Barker. I'm a professor of political science at Keene State College. I'm joined by my colleague and best friend, Dr. Bill Muck, who's a professor of political science at North Central College. Hey, Bill, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful, Phil. We've already, you know, we were just saying, we've been on the online for like an hour talking about a new idea for a podcast where we're going to like do like a class in podcast form. It's brilliant, really fascinating stuff. But after talking for an hour, I'm getting tired.
It's nap time already. We haven't even started.
That's right. Oh, no, this is really, we're sort of kicking around the idea of teaching a class, either like an international relations class or a comparative class. These are classes that, you know, you and I teach all the time, but connecting it to a podcast format where, you know, we're just thinking like that. So if our listeners think that's a good idea, let us know.
Yeah, it would be less, this podcast is great because it's every week it's, you know, related to what's going on in the world and we try to apply political science stuff. But yeah, this would be more of kind of a standalone, if you wanted to learn more about some of the concepts and ideas of political science that would be available to people. So yeah, well, hopefully we'll move forward on that and have something out in the future.
Absolutely. So, and in other things, Phil, we're bombing Iran now. This is so we've got to spend some time thinking about all of that, the implications. The good news is Trump bombed Iran for a couple days and then declared victory in a ceasefire, and he's going to get the Nobel Peace Prize. So we can work through all of that. And then at the end of the episode, we're going to talk about the mayoral race in New York City, which is really, really fascinating. Yeah. I don't think a lot of people are paying a lot of attention to it, but I think it has some implications for maybe the future of the Democratic Party. So there's a lot of sort of interesting things that we're going to kick around today.
Yeah, it'll be fun. And I was going to start talking about Trump and Iran, but I should hold off on that for a few minutes.
Well, before we dive in, remind everybody how they can stay connected with us.
Yeah, so you can go to thepoliticslab.com and you can find all our old episodes, all the information on Bill and I and the podcast. You can also find for each of the episodes, if you click on their individual links, you'll find relevant articles. So I've got a handful of articles if you want to read a little bit more about the New York City mayor stuff. New York Times has had obviously some really interesting stuff, but also there's been a lot written on Iran and the U.S. involvement there. I've tried to pick a couple of articles that are less kind of news and more sort of analysis. So if you want to read some of those, again, all of that is at thepoliticslab.com.
Well, so last week on our episode, we were talking about the conflict between Iran and Israel. And then one of the questions was, will the United States get involved? And I think at the end of that episode, you were more convinced that the United States would, and I was convinced that Trump would chicken out and not. So you once again were correct and I was wrong. Although I will say, like, I find all of what's happened to be rather stunning, right? You know, the developments. So I'm trying to remember what day it was, but the United States used our massive B-2 bombers to bring these 30,000-pound bombs to blow up and open one of the Fordow facility with this underground bunker. The United States hit two other nuclear sites. Trump came back and declared total victory.
Total devastation. Like, what did he say? It was like complete annihilation. That was his
complete
his quote.
Obliteration. Yeah, obliteration. Obliteration, right. Phil. They are totally obliterated. And so the last couple days, there have been a couple internal reports from the U.S. government, initially the Defense Intelligence Agency, saying like, well, you know, they might have got some stuff out and maybe we didn't. It wasn't quite the obliteration. And then the last 24 hours has been Trump and the Secretary of Defense attacking those reports from their own government. So it is. There's a lot to break down. I don't know, Phil. You were right, so you get to go first. What's your reaction or thoughts on what we've seen play out over the last week?
I think there's a, like, with hindsight, looking back on it, I think there. Let's talk about the decision itself, yeah. And then we can come around to some of the implications and whatnot. I think. It sounds like with hindsight, it was, you know, Trump had been sort of working his way, leaning towards this for some period of time. And it sounds like, I guess it was right after we had podcast that he, or shortly yeah. after we had podcast that he came out and said they have 2 weeks to decide, or that right. he has 2 weeks to decide.
He's going to think about it.
Yeah. And then he, like less than 48 hours later, he launch the attack. So I mean, I think there's implications to that. There's implications in terms of how that affects sort of U.S. Reliability, trustworthiness, like how that affects diplomacy and whatnot. That's on top of, you know, what does this do in terms of, you know, does this push other countries towards nuclear weapons or whatever? But I mean, I think looking back on it, maybe we should have been even more confident that he was going to do this, right? Yeah. In the sense of just thinking about who he is, thinking about the sort of conversations he had been having with Netanyahu, the sort of relationship he has with Netanyahu and Putin and others, this sort of need and this kind of fascination for a really long time with military might and power and strength and whatnot. Maybe we should have, it shouldn't be so surprising to us at all that we did this. It's still pretty shocking when you contrast that with his longstanding critique of the use of American military power, particularly in the Middle East. But again, it's another one of those where maybe we shouldn't be surprised, because as we've talked about over and over again, there are no sort of underlying principles to Donald Trump's worldview, right? I mean, it's this fondness for authoritarianism. There's this fondness for himself. But beyond that, there's not, you know, this is not, again, a Bush administration that values America, the use of American power to spread democracy and whatever. This is not an Obama administration that values, you know, cooperation in institutions. It's Donald Trump, right? And like whatever is on his mind in a given day is going to sort of determine outcome. So that is, if you buy into all of that, that is pretty problematic for the world's largest and most powerful military, right? Like, I mean, it really does. It has raised lots of questions, as it should, about, again, checks on executive power and how much, you know, how much a president should be able to make these sorts of decisions. I mean, what do you, as you look back on this decision, I mean, that's just sort of like what's going on in his head. That's not even like, was this a good decision or a bad decision?
No, I think that's right. We'll need some time to fully think through, to have some more evidence to know whether this was a good or bad decision. But as you highlight, the process of making the decision has some problems to it. Yeah. And some of the reporting has suggested that as Israel was carrying out its air campaign against Iran, Trump was watching this on Fox News and seeing how well it was going and how easy it was. And he was getting calls from people basically saying, hey, you got to get on this action. And so that was at least in part a motivator for him. Like, he's watching this and saying like, hey, this is going well. This is a clear victory. I want to be part of that. Well, that I don't think that's necessarily a good reason to start to use military action. I also think, and I don't know if there's any evidence for this or not, but I think all of the taco, you know, chants of the Trump always chickens out, I think that may have played a role, right? People were calling him a chicken. They were saying he always chickens out when it comes to hard decisions. And he sees one where he can make a decision where he looks tough and decisive and that he is a big leader and do one in a really safe way. And I think that's important to note, that the risks here were so much lower than any other time, right? I mean, a lot of other presidents have considered and been concerned about Iran's nuclear program, but Iran, you know, has had its proxy forces have been devastated, Hamas and Hezbollah and Syria. The Israelis had taken out basically all of Iran's air defenses. This was a really easy thing for Trump to do where there was very low risk. And given that circumstance, he said yes. And you're right. We probably should have thought more about all of that, that was going to be very, very enticing to Trump, which, again, I wish there was a goal. I wish he would come out and say, I think we're going to target the nuclear infrastructure, or I believe in regime change. There's none of that.
Right.
There's nothing that is guiding this other than, I think, an opportunity to look tough. And that can often lead to long-term problems. And I think we're so early in the beginning part of all this.
Well, even in his, like, in the aftermath, how he reacted to it, right? That he declares total victory and then goes on and announces a ceasefire while Israel and Iran are still bombing each other. And then sort of lashes out that they're not. All of that, again, sort of, it just, like, we've put somebody in power who it's just not, he's just not serious, right? It's like you could take a random person off the street and drop them in and they would be sort of making the, it's like he's playing a video game, not actually dealing with sort of real life implications of things. And that's deeply concerning. And it's also something that's been pretty visibly obvious about him for a decade plus. And American, the American people just have not, been willing to see it or whatever. But
Well, let's think through this. So you started by noting that Trump declared that he had completely obliterated the Iran nuclear facilities. And I think it might be worth a few minutes of our time thinking through this. What we are knowing is that we're still getting more intelligence. And it does sound like this was a significant and substantial attack. There was extensive damage. But let's think I think it's also clear that they probably didn't get everything. That there still is some uranium. There probably is some of the infrastructure left over. That despite the fact that this was a very successful mission, Iran still has the ability in the future. Now, we don't know whether that's 2 months away or 2 years away to reconstitute this program. Yeah. What do we need to be thinking about in terms of that? Because Trump just says complete obliteration. But that term implies that the problem has gone away. If there's stuff left over, Phil, that could be trouble. Right?
Yeah, it almost certainly is trouble. So, I mean, I think this is the thing, right? As it played out, when you texted me the night that we dropped the bomb, you were like, well, we're bombing Iran. I was like, oh, crap. So it was a bit of this roller coaster ride where it seemed like such a terrible decision. It seemed unnecessary. You and I talked last week about the sort of parallels to the Iraq War and this sort of confidence that they had nuclear weapons. And it just seemed like it was unnecessary for us to become involved in this conflict. And when it happened, I thought like we've opened Pandora's box here. And then it very quickly, like it became clear pretty shortly thereafter that the response was fairly muted. Iran sort of recognized, I think Iran didn't, but they're not in a place to take on the United States. So you saw Iran, they responded, but they responded against U.S. military bases, but they gave advance notice. And very much like when we killed the general in
Soleimani,
in Trump's first administration.
Yeah.
And I started to feel like, maybe this was, maybe I overthought this, right? Maybe it was, this is actually, if Iran, Iran is a bad regime, right? I mean, they are sponsors of terrorism. The people of Iran deserve so much better. Pursuing a nuclear weapon, it could, if they got one, it would change things. And I thought, well, maybe this was really effective and fairly clean. And then the report started coming out about, the concern, even at that point, even if it was effective, as we talked about last week, the concern is the long-term message this sends is you are far, it's sort of counterintuitive in some ways, but the message is you are far better off with nuclear weapons than without them. So getting close to nuclear weapons brought on this attack, but if you can get across that finish line, you can look at North Korea, right? And North Korea got nuclear weapons, 20 years ago or whatever. And, Donald Trump, they threaten each other, but we're not bombing North Korea. We're negotiating with North Korea. The overall message here is that if you are, for a country like for the world, the message becomes that pursuing nuclear weapons will draw the attention and potentially intervention of neighboring countries. But getting across the finish line, developing nuclear weapons, a la North Korea, is actually not the only correct path, but it's a pretty good path, right? You get across that. And so what I feel like the sort of lesson, not just for Iran, but for the international community here is not what the U.S. is hoping to send, which is, nuclear weapons bad, but instead, in fact, the message is you got to get nuclear weapons. You got to get them quick before people are aware and before people can intervene.
This is such an important point because it forces us to think about the incentive structure for Iran at this point. And for many, many years, they have been basically dabbling with nuclear power and weapons. And they hadn't made the decision to jump to weapons-grade uranium because they didn't feel like they needed to, but they wanted that capacity. It was a way of defying the West and the United States. But they never really had a full incentive to develop that weapon. Well, after this attack, after the devastating attack by both Israel and the United States, they need to think about what prevents this from happening again. Their conventional military doesn't do that. Yep. So how, if you're the Iranian regime, do you stay in power? You, as you noted, you look to North Korea as an example. Let's think about those states that didn't do that. Libya gave up nuclear weapons. Ukraine gave up nuclear weapons, and those states got invaded.
Iraq.
Yes, exactly, right? And so the lesson is pretty clear. So you're right. It's possible that Iran says, "Boy, we're tired of enriching uranium and we're going to be good boys now." I think the more likely incentive is that they're going to become more secretive, dig deeper bunkers, and race to a nuclear weapon because it is the one thing that can deter Israel and the United States. And we don't know these things, but if we're just thinking rationally, this is certainly going through the Iranian leadership's head at this point.
So going back to the decision to use the bunker buster bombs, right? The way they're designed, I mean, people, you know, analysts, people who understand this weapon have said beforehand that, like, even with these massive bombs, it would take like an extended campaign, right? Like, this is not like a one-time drop a bomb. It's like you bomb and then you bomb and then you bomb and you bomb and you bomb. And that's how you eventually destroy. And so then we come back to Trump, right? Yes. Who doesn't have any sort of underlying, you know, principles or values. I think he wants a quick victory. There's an argument that if you're going to do this, you should do it right. You shouldn't half-ass it. And it feels like what we kind of did was we took this moral victory. I mean, is there an argument at this point to say, hey, we've already crossed the line. We've already attacked. We should finish the job. If we're going to do this, send in the, you know, do a series of runs, you know, bomb them for a week if you have to, but actually destroy the facility, especially at this point where the entrances are supposedly caved in. So it's not like they can get to it and get, you know, important materials out. So while it's sealed off, finish it off. Yep. I don't necessarily think that's right. But once you've crossed this line, I mean, maybe that's, like, at this point, that's the best option.
I think you're right, because you think about before bombing Iran, you had diplomacy, right? We go back to 2015 with the Iran nuclear accord, the JCPOA. You had an amazing deal where Iran gave up basically all of its enrichment capacity. You had these super invasive inspections by the IAEA. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if Iran kicks every inspector out. And so now you're at a point, well, sure, we can, you know, Trump is talking about diplomacy with Iran, but I wouldn't trust Iran at this point, and you have no way to verify. Well, you know, Ronald Reagan, trust but verify. So you either have to put your faith in diplomacy where there's zero trust, or return to a full-out military invasion, which probably is more than just bombing. You probably got to put boots on the ground to check out these facilities. And you probably are drifting into regime change, right? I mean, that's where this ultimately brings us if you are going to finish the job. Now, maybe Trump can just say, complete obliteration, we've won, and that's enough. But if you really want to solve the problem, he's put himself in a really, really difficult position.
Yep. Yeah. And I mean, this is where, you know, people, there's always these Trump supporters who argue that Trump's, you know, always playing whatever, 8-dimension chess or whatever.
Yes.
And thinking, and the reality is he's not even playing checkers, right? Like, this is like, he has this very simple view of things, and we would be better off if he were thinking about the second and third order implications of stuff.
Yes.
And so that's where, you know, that's where, like, when you think about doing this, well, even that was all the reporting was, like, the military was frustrated because Trump kept coming out and, like, publicly saying stuff about, like, it was pretty clear that we were on our way to attack, and the military had to come up with, like, these schemes and diversions to keep the world from sort of knowing exactly when the attack was coming. So he's not thinking of the implications of his actions. Yeah. So he's not thinking about what does this do to Iran's desire to pursue a nuclear weapon. But it's back to, this other second and third order implications is that, like you said, you have totally undermined your credibility when it comes to diplomacy, in the sense of Iran does not want to negotiate with the U.S. after this. And even if they did, the whole, like, I'm going to give it 2 weeks and then I'm going to bomb you 48 hours later means that what you say has no credibility. And I think that doesn't just apply to Iran. It applies to other countries around the world. Like, can you actually trust what the U.S. says? And the answer is, right now, while Donald Trump is president, the answer is no, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's going to, on a whim, on, you know, after talking with, you know, a Netanyahu or having, you know, lunch with somebody, he's going to do whatever he wants to do. And so his promises mean nothing. And so you have sort of triply undermined your, you know, you've attacked the nuclear program without destroying it. You've undermined your ability to actually go the diplomatic route. You've probably encouraged Iran to pursue this. So, yeah, I mean, it starts to feel like a real, looks like a success in the short term, yep. But in the long term, I think this is, you know, becoming sort of one of it's sort of the worst of all outcomes, right? You didn't actually finish off the job, but you also don't have any room to actually sort of develop a relationship or move forward in a way that decreases Iran's desire for a nuclear weapon.
You're right. You've limited what you can do for a problem that may not have existed. Right. So remember last week we talked about that Tulsi Gabbard, the DNI, and the intelligence community as a whole did not believe that Iran was moving towards a nuclear weapon, did not believe that the supreme leader had made that decision. So, you know, Israel and Netanyahu convinced Trump that they were, but Netanyahu's been talking about this for, what, 22 years or 25 years. He's been talking about Iran wanting and moving immediately towards a nuclear weapon. So that problem may not even have existed. Which isn't to say Iran isn't a troubling country. You know, they are a bad actor, but you still have to behave responsibly because now you've boxed yourself in to a military solution. I will try diplomacy, but as you noted, it's empty diplomacy at this point. So it's going to feel real good, and he's going to be able to talk about this for a couple weeks. But if you really care about solving things more than just the political theater, a lot of mistakes have been made.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also worth pointing out, like, that there's this larger scale thing I've seen a couple of analysts point out as well. It's easy to focus just on Iran and how they respond in the next, you know, 5 years or 10 years or whatever. But this is all part of this broader shift in the international system, right? Where it goes back to the Bush administration and this idea of sort of preventative war, right? We don't like the direction you're going in, and so we're going to attack you. But you see this playing out in certainly, you know, Russia and Ukraine. This is, you know, Israel and Iran, the U.S. and Iraq, all these different examples of a world in which the most powerful countries are not necessarily trustworthy and are willing to sort of use force to prevent other countries from gaining power.
Yes.
And that's going to have huge implications, not just for Iran and Ukraine. But I mean, again, this is like we can talk about Iran in this particular instance. But the broader lesson for Ukraine is like, hey, you should develop nuclear weapons, right? 100%. Like, you want to be safe. You want to be secure. If you're, you know, Japan, if you're, you know, South Korea, any of these other countries around the world, suddenly, like, the message is that this is a two-tier system and it's the haves and the have-nots, and you're way better off being a have and having nuclear weapons and playing the role of the bully as opposed to being the role of the bullied.
This becomes or develops because of the undermining of this norm of intervention. And Russia, you know, Russia tramples that norm by invading Ukraine, but then the United States gives it legs by doing much the same, right? And talking about this. And so if you're right, if you're South Korea, if you're Japan, if you're a whole host of bad actors, you may think, well, 10 years ago, I didn't have to worry about some big power invading me. But now that that norm has been eroded, the one guarantee to keep other countries from violating our borders, from toppling my own regime, is to develop a nuclear weapon. No, you're right. This may not just apply to the Iranian nuclear program. It could be a broader norm across the international system. I mean, and that's a sort of the second, third order stuff that you're talking about that nobody, just this podcast, Phil, we're thinking through it.
Well, and it feels, I think, in initially it feels like an overreaction or it feels silly, but like think about like the, I don't know, I think about Russia, right, who has invaded Ukraine but has also made it very clear and has sort of threatened other former Soviet states. It's not just Ukraine, it's Georgia, but also, you know, like if you're the Baltic states, you are understandably nervous about what they're doing. You look at China, who has like threatened neighboring countries and all, you know, talking about Taiwan and other countries around there. And then, you know, you're like, well, the U.S. is different than that. But here we are intervening in Iran while, you know, we've talked since Trump has taken over, right, about the use of military force to take Greenland, to take the Panama Canal, right? So it feels silly, but if you're Panama or if you're Denmark or whatever, you think, like, again, back to this, like, there's no credibility to, like, you can't believe necessarily what Donald Trump is telling you or what the United States is telling you. This is like sort of classic. We for the last, 80 years, the world really did kind of operate on this sort of liberal model of institutions and cooperation. And we've talked about that breaking down. And it feels like more than ever, we are in a very realist world right now. And that's this notion of like, if you want to ensure your own safety, then you can't rely on other people. You just have to be prepared to defend yourself.
This is, it's so true. And these are the implications that will have a fallout for decades to come. It's really interesting, but also so short-sighted by the Trump administration. He's thinking about this short-term victory, so he looks good on Fox News, but this could lead to all these other countries changing their incentive structure. So more to come. And it feels like the story's dying down, but this is going to continue to reverberate for decades to come.
Yeah. It'll be really interesting to see how it all moves forward. What happens with Israel? Yeah. What happens with Iran? Yeah,
absolutely. You're talking about Trump playing chess versus checkers. And as you were saying that, I was thinking he's not even playing checkers, Phil. He's just putting the pieces in his mouth. You know, he's just chewing on. He's got all the checker pieces in his mouth.
He's playing tic-tac-toe or something. Right, yeah. Badly.
Exactly. Yes. All right. Well, we wanted to touch on the New York City mayoral race, which is sort of fascinating. I will say my son has been following this really, really closely, and it's gotten me to pay more attention to it. And there are some just sort of astounding details. So the Democrats had their primary. So this wasn't the final. It was just the Democratic primary in New York City. But whoever usually wins or whoever wins the Democratic primary goes on to be the mayor. Up until Election Day, Andrew Cuomo, the former New York governor, was the leading candidate and was the one that everybody kind of thought it was just his to win. And now some of you may remember, like, Cuomo, wasn't he the corrupt guy who was guilty of, 11 or 12 cases of sexual harassment? Yeah, that guy was the leading candidate, you know, Democratic establishment. And then there was this other candidate. So actually, there were a number of candidates, but Zohran Mamdani, who was this young upstart who was running this really exciting campaign, reaching out to young people. And as the weeks went by, he started to climb into that second position. But nobody thought he was going to win. And then Election Day comes around and he ends up winning Cuomo concedes. They have this really fascinating ranked choice voting system, which we can also talk about. So, Phil, this is really interesting, right? Mamdani is an open democratic socialist. He is a super smart guy, super engaging. He gives you Obama 2007, 2008 kind of vibes. And he is very much not your establishment Democrat. What do you think about all of these interesting developments?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. This is it's a really interesting glimpse into the state of the Democratic Party, right? And the questions, and you and I have talked about at some point we're gonna dig deep into dive. This. There's been lots of discussion, debate, arguing within the Democratic Party about what direction the party should go. This feels like this is like a really nice kind of case study in that, because you and I, we've also talked about over the years on this podcast, how both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are really kind of two different parties, right? You've got like two different sort of, the Democrats have, there's this uneasy peace between, you can see in the Republican Party as well, like the fact that they can't really, you know, govern, even though they control the institutions. In the Democratic Party, right, you have this sort of younger, more progressive wing of the party versus the more kind of old school, moderate Democratic version. And you saw that play out here. And I think like when you look at kind of the exit polling sort of return information, you see a lot of that. The New York Times did a really nice job of kind of breaking this down, where you see this division on, you know, age and race. So young people tended to vote for Mamdani. The older people tended to vote for Cuomo. Cuomo did much better with like African-Americans as opposed to, you know, white voters, economic class. So you had sort of like the educated, wealthier people who were going more Mamdani versus the sort of more working class Democrats who were going more Cuomo. And so there's this tendency to, for me to say like, well, there's, it's easy to look at this and say, well, Mamdani's the sort of model of the future, right? This more kind of, he's young, he's dynamic, he's got the young people, but he also is sort of capturing in some ways the challenge that the Democratic Party has had. The Democratic Party has really done well and continues to do well with this sort of educated, you know, upper class. And they've struggled with the what was historically the core of their base, which is sort of, you know, working class, blue collar minorities, like all of that sort of, which is kind of interesting because Mamdani's argument is really more, I mean, he campaigned on like affordability and like issues that should rent be control. Appealing to sort of the working class group, but he's not getting their votes. And so, it is. There's this really fascinating kind of question or dilemma here about is he the future of the Democratic Party, or is he like, you know, sort of the sort of, does he capture the future of the Democratic Party, or does he capture exactly what's wrong with the Democratic Party now? And I don't know what the answer is on that at this point. And I feel like he kind of gets a little bit of both. I mean, what do you think when you look at this?
Well, I think you framed it really, really well. And we will soon find out because he is, and you think about in some ways, his characteristics and his political philosophy is very unconventional. So he's young. He's a Muslim. I can't remember if I mentioned that or not. Right. And so you're already seeing the Islamophobia come out where, for sure, you know, Donald Trump and Marjorie Taylor Greene are attacking him, making references to 9/11, that ugly bigotry. And he's an open democratic socialist. Now, again, most Americans don't really understand that democratic socialism is not the same thing as communism, but it opens themselves up to this critique, right? And Trump is already doing this, saying this is a communist, and there are people calling to deport him and to pull his citizenship away. And, you know, so there's all of that, which makes it difficult to win.
That's normal and fair and good in politics, right?
When you're operating within a competitive authoritarianism, yes, 100%. But what I think is so interesting is we've entered this revolutionary moment in our politics that Donald Trump has upended our politics. We are experiencing this revolution, and when there is a revolution, there's usually not just one of them. And so, again, we need to get to this in the future, where the Democratic Party has to make some choices. I think staying the same and saying, let's try more Joe Biden, right? Let's try the younger Joe Biden. I don't think that's going to be appealing in a revolutionary moment. The Democrats also need to change. Now, we don't know what that change needs to look like. He is certainly an agent of change, right? He is a thoughtful, engaging, dynamic, young a politician who is making a compelling case for democratic socialism. Now, he's still pro-business. He's actually super, as you said, super small business, working class. He's thinking about all of those dynamics, rent control. Let's see whether this has some legs to it or not. I am curious. I don't, like you, I don't know what the answer is, but I am thrilled that the Democratic Party is gonna play around with some of these candidates, and let's see. I mean, Andrew Cuomo was like the worst option, right?
Yes, that's for sure.
Let's go back and find the worst example of a corrupt, you know, establishment Democrat and see whether that solves our problem, right? I'm so glad the voters of New York said, no, we don't want to try the same thing and a really bad version of that same thing again. So I'm excited. I have no long-term vision about whether this is going to work or not. This could totally implode, but I applaud the voters of New York to say, hey, let's try something different.
Yeah, I think, yes, whether or not, and when I talk about like whether they're the right choice or not, it's not based on, that's not me basing it on, you know, what I think are the right policies. It's me based on like what is going to be a successful strategy for the Democratic Party, right? Who's going to be able to pick up enough votes? Who can push back against the sort of change or the shift that Donald Trump has brought about in American politics. And I don't know if Mamdani's the model for that. Right. I do feel pretty confident that Cuomo is not, right? Like exactly. to use like, yes. like again, I mean, that's like you said, that's the sort of Joe Biden. It feels like there is it is time for some form of evolution in the Democratic Party, and whether that is, I think it is in some way a return to some of the kind of blue collar working class standing up for, you know, average American thing. That is a return to that, but that can go in a lot of different ways, right? It can go the sort of democratic socialist model. It can go in more of a sort of a more populist, a more sort of old school. There's lots of different directions that can go. And I think, you know, political scientists talk about this. You and I are more international political science people, but I know American politics talk about, you know, the states as sort of laboratories of democracy, right? And this is kind of the same. Cities are the same thing. Like, this is a chance in lots of different ways for different cities and different states to sort of experiment with different ideas, and we'll see which ones rise to the top. Is this the sort, like, if he's successful and wildly popular, that will, you know, start to make the argument for this is the direction to go with Democratic politics. I also feel like, you know, so much is uncertain, like you said, when there's this kind of revolution in one party, it's going to lead to a revolution or a change in the other. And I feel like we are at this weird turning point in American politics where there's debates about democracy and all sorts of other stuff. But it is also, there's this, we've talked a lot about there. It feels like there is about to be this major generational shift, right? Where the sort of, where the baby boomer generation is going to go away. But I mean, their grip on politics is very clear in that you see how many of them are in office. But when that goes away, what comes next, right? And like, how does that shift? You know, young voters are really fascinating. In some ways, they are more liberal than ever. Yep. Really, they're kind of more divided than ever, because there's all sorts of evidence that there's like major growth in this kind of populist conservative element, particularly amongst young men, right? And so, you know, all of that is, again, we're at this place where so much is kind of up in the air, and it'll be really interesting to see how politics sort of settles and what the realignment is that comes out of it.
This is such a good point, right? Especially the idea of mobilizing young voters, because that's what Mamdani has done. And Democrats have struggled to do that, right? Joe Biden didn't do it. Hillary Clinton didn't really do it enough. And I think the last Democratic candidate to really do that was Barack Obama, right? And I think about the energy. That's why I think there's some similar feel there. And that's exciting. That's something the Democratic Party has not been able to bottle. And I hope this happens. And
the young people that he motivated 15, 20 years ago are not young anymore. Right?
No,
like
they're
like, this is, yeah. So there's this whole new generation that has never experienced politics other than the era of Donald Trump, right?
Yeah. And that's so important to give young people something to believe in, a politician that sort of looks like them. Mamdani's 33, which that's pretty young, right? And the other day I saw a video of him. He was asked about Israel and Netanyahu, and he weighs in on those, and he's again thoughtful about it. But there was a question about the ICC has a warrant out for Netanyahu's arrest. Now, the United States is not a member of the ICC, so Netanyahu can travel to the United States and not worry about being arrested. But they asked him, would he arrest Netanyahu if he came to New York? And he said, yes, I would. And I found myself going, oh, that's not safe politics, right? And my initial reaction is, don't say that. But maybe that's the kind of thing that you do need to say, is to break out of these things. Now, let's have real conversations, right? Let's talk about this. And it's okay to lean in on controversial issues, which we've seen Trump do remarkably well by leaning into these difficult issues. And so maybe we're seeing a Democratic version of it. So I've got my popcorn, and I want to watch how this all plays out.
It'll be interesting to see, because it does feel like Democrats have spent a long time constantly trying to sort of take the pulse of what people want them to, as opposed to like, these are the things we believe in, and we're going to campaign on those, and whether we win or lose is a reflection on the values that we stood up for, as opposed to like, we're always trying to test the waters and play the game. And it'll be interesting.
Well, the other, I know we got to wrap up, but the other thing is there, this ranked choice voting system that New York uses, which is it seems more complicated than it really is.
It's the best bill.
Oh, it's really good. Like, political scientists love this because you go in and you don't just vote for one candidate. If there are seven candidates, you can rank all seven, or you could rank your top three. And then as the process plays out, they sort of work through. And if your candidate is the lowest number of votes, you know, they're wiped clear. But then those votes go to the second choice. Like, it's such a smart system, and it makes politicians campaign in different ways. And so it's also, I'm so pleased to see that we're getting some experience with a ranked choice voting system, and to see that it can work and that voters can actually figure it out. And I'm thrilled by that as well.
It's a movement that has gained a lot of, even to my students, like, years, 10 years ago, it felt like my students had no idea, had never heard of it. And now they come into class, like, that's the one they're interested in. Yeah. And a number of states have taken it up. But yeah, I mean, there's so many benefits to it. But one of the main ones is that it rewards candidates who can pick up sort of a broad base of support, as opposed to, Cuomo, I haven't seen the returns, but this is a perfect example of that. There's a lot of people who probably like Cuomo, like, for whatever reason they vote for him. But if you didn't like Cuomo, if you like that guy's, you know, corrupt and he has all sorts of other issues, you're unlikely to say, I like this other guy, but Cuomo is my second choice, right? Like, and right, so yes. Somebody who can actually gather a broader base support is more likely to win. So the sort of more extreme candidates don't tend to do as well in these systems. And yeah, I mean, there's just so much. This is where, like, if we do this other podcast, we can do a whole class session on different election systems and why they're, what are the good and bad of them. But there's a lot of good stuff with the ranked choice voting. It's how we should do it nationwide. It's my opinion.
I totally agree, 100%. So, well, this is probably a good point to wrap up on. All right, Phil, we will see what another week brings us. Maybe more peace and diplomacy, maybe more conflict. Who knows? But I'll tell you what, there's always something happening every week.
More total obliteration, or whatever Trump said.
Why don't you remind everybody how they can stay connected with us?
Yeah, so go to thepoliticslab.com, and I'll throw there's a couple of the pieces from the New York Times on that race and some of the exit polling stuff. But yeah, there's been a couple of articles this week about the implications of the U.S. attack on Iran and how that might actually accelerate nuclear programs, not just in Iran and other places. So there's several articles that I'll put up there as well. You can find all of those on the webpage if you go to this week's episode link. And again, that's thepoliticslab.com.
Fantastic. All right, Phil, I will see you next week.
Bye, Bill.
Bye, Phil.